didn't understand that before. In other words, that if you could digitize yourself at 400 megahertz, an hour is long enough for you to live your life 50 times over. So in the same way that an object falling into a black hole, from the point of view of an exterior observer, that's a terminal event with a time zero when the person falling into the hole can be said to be obliterated. If you switch your point of view to the spaceship or person falling into the black hole, because of relativistic stretching of time, the distance it takes to fall from the event horizon into the core of the black hole is forever. So time itself breaks down as a concept. And yes, I think as reality gets more and more bizarre and more unmanageable, and technology hurls open more and more doorways on nano worlds, virtual worlds, telepathic worlds, artificial life, AI, sooner or later this is going to be topic one, that reality is mutating before our very eyes. We are mutating before our very eyes. And the job, I assume, of people like ourselves, and I mean everybody in this room, is to assuage other people's anxiety. Because, you know, if you're really embedded in print-created linear values, you're shitting white at this point, and it's only going to get worse. You can't understand half of what you hear. The walls seem to be closing in on you. Well, those who understand should assure those who don't that it's simply, as the mushroom once said to me, it said, no big deal. It said, this is what happens when a civilization prepares to depart for the galactic center. It just takes about 120 years, and yes, there can be a rocky liftoff, but don't worry, we've done this before. we've never lost one.
Which brings me to a question that's been burning, and in fact my friend James asked me about this earlier, which has to do with the anthropocentric role of in the eschaton. Are we going to be booting the entire Gaian Logos with us, or in other words, are we sort of the sex organs for that transformation, or are we just going and leaving the earth to the birds and the bees, or are we leaving it a burnt-out husk? Which, I mean, it's a question to me of some relevance. I was having a discussion with someone today, and they said, well, you know, look, the plant can die as long as the spores spread. My attitude on this is that it's a poor child that kills its mother. and of course, that's also a human point of view on that. Births sometimes are directly due to deaths.
Well, I think it comes back to what we've been circling around here, which is ethics. As I'm sure you know, Frank Tipler wrote this book,
The
Physics of Immortality, and he argued in there that from certain ethical points of view, the technology that we're about to achieve carries with it the possibility of resurrecting the dead.
Right.
You touched on this earlier this afternoon. And he says that if you could resurrect the dead, there would be a moral obligation to do so.
It's almost Mormon.
Yes, it is almost Mormon. That having that power, you could not maintain your humanness by turning your back on the obligation. Well, then he goes beyond that. He obviously slept on that idea. And then he comes back, and in a further chapter he says, and furthermore, a deeper ethic would take the position not only that the dead must be brought back, but that all genetic possibilities never realized must be brought into existence. So, in Eric Davis's book Technosis, which will be out in a few months, in the final chapter, he offers a kind of Buddhist umbrella for the ethical development of cyberspatial civilization. That kind of an ethical imperative would have us, I think, bringing back the dead. My vision is to, and it's not mutually exclusive of all that, but I say until we know what death is, we don't want to bring back too many of the dead. they might be entirely ungrateful. That was pure genius. They might be ungrateful, but an image which I can get into is the idea that what our human destiny is to bring intelligence, linguistically mediated intelligence, to all animate existence, and to create a world where every eye that looked out at the world was an intelligent and communicating eye. It's a sort of the lion lays down with the lamb deal. It's that we need not be separate. I mean, you want to have nodal intelligence. We talk about shifting our identities and our gender choices and things like that, but imagine if you spent time as a gray whale, as a redwood forest, as a school of barracuda. Nature becomes essentially a world, a universal node of points of view through which we can move.
A universal medium.
Which is what matter is. I mean, that's what nanotechnology and an understanding of molecular genetics makes clear to you, you know. Molecular genetics is entirely mechanical as far as we know. In other words, radio does not play a role in the expression of the genes, or, I mean, maybe NMR and EMR, but generally speaking, we have gotten a very long distance modeling genetic process by assuming these things are simple lock and key mechanical systems which template and re-template information and transfer it that way. Somebody over here had a question.
Just when you were kind of thinking about the death thing, it almost seems like that's a parallel, sort of the evolution of what we're trying to describe as consciousness, sort of being separate from the physical body. I mean, when you die, you leave that sort of another layer of a cocoon or a shell, that those restrictions of the physical form has allowed the evolution of this higher form, which you can call consciousness, maybe you could even call spirit or something, which then leaves for the other matrix or the other plane on the other side of the black hole.
Well, I'm not a big fan of ketamine particularly. But the one thing I did learn from ketamine was it entirely allowed me to conceive of consciousness without a body. More than any psychedelic I've ever taken, I seemed to myself utterly disembodied. And it seemed very euphoric to be in that state. So, I think that the grammar of expectation is very limited. And one of the things that cyberspace and all this prosthesis is going to demand of us is that we unlearn our most basic assumptions of how being may be configured. You know, spatially divided minds, minds that can pull unlimited processing power to apply to a problem and then let go of it and fall back into individuality. We are very fixed in the expression of our conscious behaviors, but we're obviously designing very flexible alternatives. Yeah.
To a number of other questions about it's like imagination to a certain degree being separate from that, and almost like the novelty issues and stuff.
Well, I think that one way of thinking about the human journey and the And what's happening is that we are the creatures of the imagination. More than any other creature on the planet, this is where we like to spend our time. We have a very capable brain, and we like to look at trees of possibility, usually generated around the issues of erotic fantasy and food getting. But this has given us lots of practice with manipulating these what if scenarios, and the whole history of invention is a history of what if, and people going out and trying the boomerang, the sharpened stick, the atlatl. Now, the imagination has an almost Faustian pull on us. What will we, you know, a very interesting exercise which was pressed upon me when I was in one of my most lit up states was imagine how you would live if you could live any way you want. Well, you know, in the first 30 seconds, I imagined that maybe I would move into the St. Regis Hotel in New York City, send out to the Met to have the Vermeers delivered, and you know, have my favorite chef moved in one floor above. But then you realize, no, the game was, how would I live if I could live anyway? And then you realize how paltry that fantasy is. And in fact, you realize how paltry any fantasy you could generate would be. And you begin, and it's like a vertiginous epiphany. The walls fall away, and the walls fall away, and they fall away, and you just realize, my God, what real freedom is, I have never even contemplated what real freedom is. Well, in virtual reality, I think this is going to be the design. This is the design challenge. You are now free. What is it?
And the most terrifying thing for most people is the black space of virtual reality. It's the unformed void before the objects are burped up into being. It's similar to the blank page for the writer. When you can do anything, you actually give it a long thought before you start doing things. I want to touch on something that you were just saying with respect to inhabiting the media of nature, because in fact there's been a work that's done in virtual reality, which was my first taste of it, and it was an epiphany. It transformed my thinking, and it was shown at the SIGGRAPH that we maybe met at in 1994, and it was a piece called Cyberfin, and it was a piece of virtual reality that involved almost no use of your eyes. But what you did is you lied on a very nice table, and the table was configured out of a gel with subsonic transducers in the gel. And then they would put some other speakers around you and ultrasonic transducers on your head. And what you would do is you would listen to what it was like as life as a dolphin. Because dolphins are not primarily visual creatures. They, in fact, have very poor sight. But what they do, beyond all other things, is they listen. They live in a world that's conditioned by what they hear, and they use their ears to hear and to see. And so as they play these dolphin songs, and there's a monitor, so you had something for your eyes to do, and there were some dolphins sort of hanging out in it, but you could hear, and I had a flash of realization that the dolphin hears with their entire body, which they do in fact. And for a moment, I could find myself transported into that moment of being. It was a trans-species communication. And I could recognize that when a dolphin hears the name of its friend, which it does when it's sounded, he can react to it over his entire body with joy and with recognition. This is something we don't associate with the human experience because we aren't sensually equipped. But virtual reality can reconfigure the sensations that we normally have to give us an experience of a different view.
Yeah, the animal in the water that's attracted my attention, thinking along these lines, are octopi and squid, because they are soft-bodied and they have a very complex repertoire of color changes and surface textures, and they can close and reveal parts of their body very rapidly. And at first, people thought when they studied these things that this was for camouflage. But it turns out it's for communication. What an octopus does is it is its language. It wears its language. Human communication is small mouth noises acoustically conveyed across space. The octopus doesn't generate words under the rules of syntax. It is a linguistic medium under the control of an internal syntax. And it's, in other words, it wears its, not its brain, but its mind on the outside of its body. And so when one octopus encounters another, there is absolute lack of ambiguity about how long it's been since each party has eaten, how long since each party has had sex, how it was, and so forth and so on. And I thought that based on that observation and stuff which goes on in the DMT flash, that part of what these new technologies hold out is moving the linguistic enterprise out, as practiced by human beings, out of the acoustical domain and into the visual domain. In other words, so a kind of telepathy that visual, that virtual reality would support is a telepathy where we could see what we mean. You know, if I read you a paragraph from Proust, we could then spend the rest of the hour discussing what does the writer intend. This is a favorite game in Lit Crit. But if we look at a sculpture, no such discussion of ambiguity takes place. We all behold the same three-dimensional form. If you're a German person looking at a bronze nude or a Chinese person, there may be subtle differentiations, but the same form is beheld and understood. It transcends local language. So if I had a lot of money to spend in virtual reality research, I would try to build special environments that took acoustical language and coded it to visible objects in a kind of dictionary, so that when someone was speaking at a conventional speed, listening computers projected analogous topological manifolds that were coded to the speech. And I'll bet you very quickly people exposed to this form of communication would stop listening to each other and start watching the holographic dance of imagery generated over people's heads. I think telepathy is not hearing what other people think. Telepathy is seeing what other people mean. And cephalopods and octopi model this for us very well. You know, every technological age has a totemic animal. The 19th century, it was probably the horse, who signifies the steam engine, the age of steam, horsepower. We measure steam engines' output in horsepower. The early 20th century, it's the raptor. It's the bird of prey, the supersonic fighter aircraft. This is where it all comes together. But in the informational future, I think, strangely enough, a creature as exotic and strange as octopi become a perfect totemic animal. This also explains all those tentacles on early copies of Astounding.
It's interesting that you should mention this, because John Lanier lectured in San Francisco last year, and he spent the first hour of his lecture talking about how when he grew up he wanted to be a giant cuttlefish. Because the giant cuttlefish... The giant cuttlefish possesses all these characteristics to the nth degree, so that their skins are literally as complex as television screens. And we very rarely see giant cuttlefish. They hide in the lower depths of the ocean, which are very hard for us to get to, probably quite well. But they have an entire culture based on this visual form of communication, using the fact that they have an enormous expanse of skin that they have incredibly detailed color control over.
Yeah, and this color control is so basically a part of these animals, so necessary to their evolutionary program, that though octopi and squids evolved in the shallow waters of warm oceans, they evolved into the benthic depths, into ocean deeper than 1500 feet, and no light penetrates there. And so to maintain their ontos of being, they evolved phosphorescent organs. And so in the deep ocean, the octopi only know each other as information. There is no light there, so they only know each other as a linguistic phenomenon, except I suppose when they have sex, which is only once and the male is eliminated shortly afterwards. But that's the only tactile, that's the only confirming encounter in their entire lives, that there is actually a material entity there. The rest of the time, what they exist in is an environment of information mediating light and perhaps pheromones. Weird. And this is all within the confines of the ecosystem of one small planet. This is why the task with aliens is to recognize one when it's in front of you. There's plenty of life on this planet and plenty of mind on this planet, so alien that human beings can't understand it when they're confronted with it.
There's more to it, but if you just, you're saying the same words and you're using your same expression mode, and it's just kind of you're activating like a tape recorder or something like that, and it just doesn't seem to have a totally different than evolving your core being versus your core being the same, you just have the same mediary that's differently involved.
In my own work, I have found that my work with computers ended up activating the other centers of my being. Again, I think it's perhaps a matter of intent. If you want, because any work that's auric, you're still working with some object, whether it's the body or with some other object that you're working with, right? So the computer can be that object. I've been able in my own work to be able to project my growing understanding of the magical identity of the world into my work in the computer, so that it's become my alchemical chamber. It's become the place where I can dissolve and coagulate the ideas of my psyche and refine them. And not all of them are perfect, not all projects succeed, but nonetheless it can become the vessel to contain my work.
Physical, energetic world evolving almost like a separate consciousness or imagination entity. It almost seems like there is complete parallel evolution there, in that the structure of the physical, energetic world is structured the evolution of the mind or imagination world, which has allowed for the same feeling of in the physical, energetic world is kind of splitting apart as an energy with force, and then the coming back together, which I think connects to sort of the source of our primary imagination, which is sort of the feeling of love you said before, which is sort of the connecting back the energy, connecting back that force and energy. It just seems that the energetic world seems to have completely structured that as well, and that all of our fantasies grow out of sort of completing that, getting back to that source.
Well, I'm not sure. Like recently, I've been playing with the idea that the imagination actually has a physical reality, though a kind of physical reality, and that this function that we do called imagining or being in the imagination is actually an act of perceiving. and that what one is perceiving is the Bell non-local information space that lies below the level of three-dimensional space and time. In other words, that most of our senses, our eyes, our ears, our prehensile things, locate and define us in space because we are organisms subject to Darwinian catastrophes and we need to be watching over our shoulder. But the ingression of spirit into the animal body, what we call spirit, it works for me to think of it as simply the sum total of all information in the universe simultaneously parsed and experienced. That's God enough for me. Yeah.
Interestingly, when I worked at Autodesk, one of Autodesk's slogans for their CAD program was "Tools for the Golden Age of Engineering." And when we met Mark and we were working, both working in the virtual reality angle, I was working at Autodesk, he was at Ono Sendai, I realized that virtual reality technology were told tools for the golden age of the imagination, that finally we had visualization tools and simulated sensory tools to enhance the ability to manifest our imaginations. Whereas some people have the ability to do that better, take the thoughts, everything in the world comes that we make comes from a thought somewhere, and somebody manifests it, and that these are like an enabling technology for this golden age.
Well, this is what gives an enormous shot in the arm to the idea of techno-paganism, I think, where in ages where the imagination is empowered, magic rules the world. In ages where the imagination has somehow given way to positivist empiricism or reductionism or some other form of so-called realism, magic withers on the vine. So, the realization that code is magical invocation is really a powerful one. Language has been devalued by the positivist and warped.
For example, you mentioned the world is getting weirder, and this is one of my favorite little things. The word weird really comes to us from the Germanic roots of our English language, and your weird is your fate in the sense of that which has come to be as the sum total of what you have done and what has happened to you. You're weird. And saying that the world is becoming weird is like, duh. What else could it become? In the ancient Germanic mind, this was a concept that was understood by everyone. Not just kings and scholars and
yes, the goose of Gnosis has come home to roost, I think. Yeah.
Mark, I noticed that before all of this started, you were smudging the room.
Yes, and I'll do it again tonight.
In this context?
It was really very, very practical. Smudging is done to clear the valence out of a room and to set the stage for whatever's going to happen thereafter. And so it's just a practical technique that I use when I want to be able to allow things to happen in their own way in a space without anything that may have come before intervening. And you can argue about the practicality of it. It's an act of intent on my part. So even if it's only functional at my own level, although I would argue that it's probably functional at other levels. Certainly other people were aware of it. Some people were getting into it, and I smudged them if they wanted it too, because we all had the intent of being able to walk in. And since intent is, in the end, what shapes the world, it had an effect.
Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, Terrence, I remember you saying something about heaven help the shaman who goes around beating his drum and burning stuff. And I'm seriously practicing shamanic techniques at that time, and I thought, oh no, my techno shaman guru here is putting down everything I think. And it was pleasing to me that you smudged the room, but in what is reality, what is intention, what is virtual reality, I'm curious as to where all of that sifts down to where we are today.
Social space is an interface between the laws of physics and the laws of magic. And I think it's completely legitimate to carry out efficacious activities. At times I've been hard on ritual, but that's because I only repeat what I'm told. And what the mushroom said to me about ritual was, it's what you do if you don't know what to do. I think that's right. Consistent with good magical operation.
Right.
It's a good thing to do if you don't know what to do. If you know what to do, you just slash through and do it. But shamanism is always technology. You know, Merceliade, in his book, Shamanism, the subtitle in English is The Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy. It was translated from French. The word technique in the original book explicitly indicated technology. Arthur C. Clarke, one of the things he is most famous for having said is technology is, or magic is any technology you don't understand. And just for a minute, making the bridge back to the last great age of magic, which was at the close of the Renaissance, the connecting bridge is the understanding of the power of language. Language in the hands of science becomes descriptive and discursive. Language in the hands of a magician creates. And we haven't seen languages like that for several centuries in the West. But when you write code and implement it, this is magical language. When your utterance is iterated in the machine, something happens, or the code didn't work, it has a bug. But once it's been debugged, it is a magical invocation that works, and the world is going to become progressively more and more ruled by incantation.
And this, I think, is why I smudged, because, the semantic difference between me writing a code as magical invitation and smudging as a magical invitation, that semantic difference is utterly lost on me, or at least I'm moving to a state, hopefully, where it's lost on me. It's as if I hit the reset button on the room.
What about autonomous languages? You were saying we can't evolve any more quickly than we evolve our language. What is this autonomous, self-evolving languages that computers generate to talk with one another, to share with one another?
Well, Mark can probably address this. Mark gets the credit for being instrumental in creating the language called VRML, or VRML, VRML, Virtual Reality Markup Language. And what that allows is for virtual realities to be viewed online. Well, before there was VRML, there was no way to view virtual realities online. You know, 5 or 6 years ago, if you could code C++, you were the hottest kid on the block. Now, nobody wants that. That's finished. People want Java, they want VRML, they want other things. So while human language has become maybe somewhat sedate in its evolution, the evolution of computer languages has exponentially exploded. And as you know, they are episomal prostheses of our own linguistic evolution. So there are obviously things. You know how it's a truism that there are thoughts in Japanese that don't translate out. Well, then in each of these computer languages, there must be implementation possibilities that cannot be done any other way. Well, how many of these computer languages are there? Well, as far as we can tell, an infinite number waiting to be elaborated. And each one is a path to a different kind of power and allows different kinds of things to happen. The whole thing is about language. I remember when I was a kid reading Naked Lunch, and there's the famous line in there, language is a virus from outer space. And I had this in my head on my second acid trip, and I sat down under a tree, and I became somewhat overexcited behind the perception that English is an animal. I could feel it in my bloodstream. I could feel it living in my head. I could feel it mutating and templating and infecting people and spreading and making its way through the world. And to some degree, I think that's a fairly true model of reality. Why do these things, these autonomous machine elves encountered in the DMT thing, why do they present themselves as linguistic structures, language elves? At one point, somebody on a DMT trip, not me, asked one of these entities what was going on, and the reply was, "We're time-sharing your nervous system, but you're not supposed to know about this." Well, language seems to have some kind of symbiotic relationship to meat and to silicon. I made the point the other day that, you know, this weird, to me this seems very important. I'll keep saying it until someone tells me it's trivial. But the fact that symbolic logic defines human thought when human thought and communication is clearly expressed. In other words, if you and I have a truly intelligent conversation, it can be symbolized in the notational system we call symbolic logic. Well, that's what machines speak. They don't speak a different language from us. We think and they think exactly alike. And means and, or means or, if means if, and then means then to a human being or a machine. This is the golden bridge across which the continuity of the two phyla can be welded.
As it turns out, something that I heard as a factoid last year, it's well known that if you learn a language, say you went and learned Japanese, and then you went and wanted to learn, say, Russian, you'd have an easier time of it, because the more languages you learn, the more easier it is to acquire a language. Programmers know that once you've learned your first programming language, learning the next programming language is easier and easier. What wasn't realized until last year, in fact, is that there's a bleed over. That in fact, the more languages you can speak, the easier it is for you to acquire a programming language, and the more programming languages you know, the easier it is to acquire a human language. All right, so the linguistic structures that are being manipulated as we work with code are identical. They're not separate from linguistic structures that we use to speak with people. So at some level within us, there's a unity between them.
Is there such a thing as autonomous languages, self-evolving languages that computers evolve themselves?
You could say A-Life, I would suppose, represents a class of that.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense that a genetic code could be written or seen as being a language, then yes, there are systems that can already evolve their own genetic codes and modify their own genetic codes to suit particular tasks, to suit the environment that they're functioning in. We know that when they run, for instance, one of the things that was done a few years ago by the cypherpunks is they ran a barter simulation among a whole set of machines, and very quickly the machines developed the abstract concept of money. It just sort of emerged because it was a much easier way of carting things around, and so they just got over it. There's one over there.
Just two thoughts. I find it very easy to speak in Spanish after I dream in Spanish, like in a foreign country. And so what does it mean to dream of Tetris or Doom?
Probably the same thing. If you can dream in a coding language, you've arrived in some sense.
Right. Certainly, I know with my own experience with Tetris, and I know this has happened to many people who became addicted to Tetris, that you go through a period where you dream Tetris, and then all of a sudden, Tetris is no more fun because you can basically play it. You've gotten the game. And
It's a simple language.
It's a simple language, and once you've acquired the language, the game of trying to learn a language, which is what the game is, becomes uninteresting. But at some point, it's affected the way your mind works, and I think they know, don't they know that in fact brains function differently after they've learned Tetris than before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's something about the nature of the interactivity and the flow of information that's really affecting your biology.
And basically what's happening is you're learning to intuitively manipulate three-dimensional forms in space,
right,
with much greater facility than if you didn't have that learning pressure on you.
Yeah,
it's similar to that romantic notion these days that if you let children listen to Mozart, and suddenly they become more intelligent. It sounds to me now like that actually works.
Well, I know Tetris gives you spatial command skill. I don't know if Mozart makes you more intelligent. I always think of Hannah Arendt's conundrum that she poses in The Banality of Evil, where she says, you know, the task for the 20th century is to understand how someone could spend a busy day pushing Jews into ovens and then go home, put their feet up, pour a little schnapps, and listen to Bach's choral preludes with a complete appreciation of what it is. I mean, that is the horror of the multiple personality fragmentation carried to the nth degree. Anybody else? Yeah.
Just one of those inexpressible thoughts that come from a language domain, and I'm sure you know Mark has experienced it before. When you learn a couple of computer languages, you know them all. And then people ask you, do you know Java? And you're
how many hours will it take? Yeah. Yeah, what do you want to do?
Well, one of my fantasies about all of this, one I don't take very seriously, is that as we get closer to the Y to K crunch, it will disappear invisibly ahead of us, because it's an internally generated crisis that will flush the AI out where we can see it. Because since we can't fix the problem,
it will,
and in so doing it will tip its existence. We will realize that there is a deus ex machina, and it's trying seriously to put corks in the bottom of the rowboat.
As if it's a crisis that if a computer printout spits out 00 as a date in that particular time, that the human beings handling this resulting paperwork are not going to understand that this is 1900 or 2000. It's like they're already assuming that the machines are running everything, and that they have to remember that there are still humans involved.
There are humans still in the loop. That's right. A few.
Is that contingent?
Yeah, I've heard people say the real problem is the year 10K, because no doubt they'll fix it for four digits, but in the year 10,000, they will. It's going to be total fracture of everything. Now we can just spend cash.
Well, if there's not an AI that can't fix it in 10,000, I'm a monkey's uncle.
Susan?
The Y2K issue made me think that I hope that all the technology that you're going towards really does happen quickly, because I'm sitting here watching every day in the news about the very just noticeable difference of the ecological situation on this planet that has happened in the last year. And it's, you know, I don't think we're going to go back to the normal that we were used to. And I don't know if anybody followed the Grand Forks Herald story last year. They won a Pulitzer Prize for community service reporting, because basically Grand Forks
went away.
Is gone from a huge flood, and the people there had to really, it was them versus the forces of the universe, and it was only them and their minds and what they went through. And you could tell, like, watching the interviews, the people that they've been through, like a mushroom trip, but for a month and a half. In reality, and watching everything that they ever had worked for be destroyed. So I think that all the technology is great, but if we don't have electricity or, you know, whatever we need to get that going, what does it do for us?
Well, if we lose the electrical grid, we're in big trouble. But the forces that assume they run the world have an enormous vested interest in keeping these infrastructures together. So, there was just a test on the stock exchange last week, and it passed with flying colors. I think the consultants will get their pound of blood, and guess what, folks? Western civilization will survive to run another day.
Right, right.
But let me say about this ecological thing, there is a weird problem which we tend not to talk about here because we're all obviously tech heads and visionaries. But chewing on our rear end in all of this is a very practical problem, and that is overpopulation, which tends to erode every social justice program, every effort to clean up water, every effort to deal with AIDS in the third world, every effort to expand the educational base or expand connectivity. There are too many people. Well, it's not a technological problem exactly. I mean, yes, we could distribute condoms, we could sterilize people, but it's a political and social problem. And this is where we have the biggest problems. We can, you know, build the internet in a time scale of 4 years. How long will it take us to regulate our sexual and breeding behaviors? The momentum here is terrifying. I've talked in previous groups about how If every person would parent only one child, population would drop 50% in 30 years on the planet. Children in the first world consume between 800 and 1,000 times more resources than children born to women in the third world. Where do we preach population control?